My name is Jonathan McNeese, joined by my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
How you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Doing a lot better now since I finished the ceramic tile job I was working on earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I got it all put down. I hadn't gone back and grouted it yet, but I got the worst part done, so.
I always hated the grouting, too, though. But
I don't love it, but it's not as bad as the rest. It just doesn't take as long to.
Yeah.
It's not all the getting up and going and cutting stuff, and because I'm had a wet tile saw set up outside, so I was running back and forth. Anyway,
yeah,
it's in the construction zone podcast. So,
well, I mean, it's been sort of a maintenance type week, or you know, top few weeks for me. So, you know, I'm getting close to it. First, I had my oven go down, and that's why I was at your shop last week when we did the live stream. And then this week, I don't know if you saw, but my grinder went down on me.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, the tracking, the screw for the tracking wheel stripped out and the bolt stripped out. So I couldn't just find a bolt and, you know, figure it out. And it was a welded on nut. So I had to do some redneck fabrication and get it working in the meantime. I mean, I called Ameribraid and they basically said they don't, you know, make them like that anymore. And so here, we're sending new parts to you. So, so they took care of it right away and, you know, we're great about it, but still got stuff to do in the meantime, you know. Still need the grinder.
Yep. Still need to be grinding.
But yeah, so it's been.
That's cool. I've never actually owned any Ameribraid stuff, but from seeing their stuff, like they seem like innovate a lot. They seem to be constantly coming up with new stuff. So they're very interesting.
They are.
I'll get the market for another one. I might have to look at them.
Yeah. They seem to think outside the box that a lot of other grinder companies don't think in.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's from their different background and stuff like that, but I've been using it for 3-4 years now, and this is basically the first problem I've had out of it. So, you know.
Yeah.
And
that's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. Right. Not cool that your grinder's torn up, but
yeah, especially considering the timing that, you know.
Yeah, that's when everything's always going to happen when you're leading up to a show or something. You can just about count on it.
Yep. And on that note, Blade Show Texas is 25 days away when at the time of this recording, which is on Sunday.
25 days.
Yeah.
So coming up pretty quick. That's pretty quick for us.
Yeah.
Those of you that are attending and may looking forward to it, it may seem like a while, but yeah, that's a lot to get done between now and then.
Yeah, especially considering, you know, having to leave a day or so early to, you know, get out there and all that. And
yeah, we've got actually less time than that to get done, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yep. Yeah. But I am really looking forward to it, and I think that's kind of the only real news that we have this week of anything kind of noteworthy is that Texas is coming up, and like I said, 25 days away. And we've mentioned it several times on the show, but guys, if you're able to come to the Texas show, I highly encourage you to do it. It's turning into a really cool show. Ever since Blade Show took it over, it's really been growing and they're doing their thing with it. It's kind of like a mini Atlanta, but with, I don't know, it's got a different vibe. Honestly,
I've heard that a lot.
All three of the shows it's partly, I think, because you're in a different geographical area.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just that. Atlanta brings people from all over.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have a fair amount of locals there that are local-ish or local, but it brings people from all over the world. So, like, you're around just, you know, tons of people from everywhere there. It's a really big mix. Texas, I would say, there's still people from all over the world, but I would say it's a lot more local crowd than you get probably at Atlanta, or at least maybe just it seems that way because it's not as big and crazy or whatever. But
yeah, I mean, to kind of drive that point home, like right behind me, there was a guy from Australia, and then the next row over from that was GTC, who's from Brazil, and then across the aisle there was a guy from South Africa, and
I think maker wise, people are still coming from all over the world, and you're gonna have some. Yeah. Customers that are still coming from all over the world, but I think on the customer side of it, it's not as broad. I feel like it's more people that are, you know, it's a really hardcore knife enthusiast that travel from, you know, wherever, and then you got a lot more seems like local crowd there.
Yeah,
I know when we talk to people and ask them where they're from and stuff, it just seems like there's a lot more people that are are from Texas when we're at that show versus people that are from Georgia when we're in Atlanta.
Gotcha. So, yeah. I wasn't thinking about it on the customer side, I guess. So that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, oh yeah. There's plenty of people from all over the world coming to exhibit. So for sure, it's not like a little local show or whatever. We just get the local makers there. It's for sure got people from all over, but I do think the customer base is slightly different, and I get along pretty good so far with the Texas folks. So they're not that much different than the Alabama folks, doesn't seem like. So
yeah,
it was a pretty fun show for us. So
yeah, and that's March 7th and 8th for those that are wondering. And it's the Fort Worth Convention Center, I think, is where it's held at. But you can go to BladeShowTexas.com and get all the information, tickets, and all that stuff. So
yep. That's right, and it's a really pretty area. Not knocking Atlanta, but like I don't really care to go out and about too much around Atlanta. But there, which we don't go out. We're usually working and like mingling and networking and all that, so we're usually not very far from the hotel there either. But just the whole kind of downtown area there and everything is pretty cool to me. I like it. It's a little different.
Gotcha.
That, and I don't know that the Atlanta one is so much that it's in Atlanta as it is just the location of the venue. Like there is some cool stuff around over the stadium and stuff over there. But it's not exactly in like a downtown kind of area either.
No, it's sort of outskirts, you know, like,
yeah, not as much stuff kind of like right there in walking distance. Like
there's
stuff close enough, but it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
The Texas show seems a little different as far as that part of it goes. There's lots of restaurants and all that stuff right there around the venue and all. So
sweet. I was going to ask you offline, but you know, considering other people may want to know as well, is there anything similar to the pit that sort of happens at Texas, or is it just?
No, not that I know of. I don't know of a particular hangout spot there that I can remember seeing. If there are, there may be, and we may just not be cool enough to know about it yet, but we may not be in with the cool kids crowd.
Yeah.
But no, not that I know of, because it's partly, I think, because the venue is separate from the hotel. Like, it's not part of the hotel and all, like Atlanta is. So I don't know of, I think for the far as I've seen, other than just people kind of hanging around outside the lobby and stuff like that, but not anywhere that like goes on, you know, big gathering place into the night, like Pitt does. So
Remember seeing, I don't remember if it was at Blade Show West or Texas, but a couple of years ago, I remember seeing somebody like trying to organize basically a pit type thing.
Yeah.
It was at like a separate location, and they, you know, rented out a venue or something, and, you know, a whole bunch of people came, but I don't know if that's still going. I don't remember who that was.
Cool idea. I think it's always going to be a little bit of an uphill battle when people have to completely leave.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's all the venue in Atlanta, for those of you that aren't familiar, it's the hotel where the majority of people stay, not everybody, but the majority of people stay, is connected. It's all technically in the same building. It's a pretty good little walk, you know, down a few hallways and stuff like that, but to get to the actual venue for the show, but it all is still in the same building and still connected, versus when you start having to get people, you know, getting transportation from the venue to somewhere else, people end up scattering, and you know, these people are going to this restaurant, these are going to this bar, and it's not just not as much of a centralized meeting place like there is in Atlanta. But
yeah, I mean, I guess that's one of the things that can keep Atlanta special, because that's, you know, one of my favorite parts is being able to just, you know, you're sitting there walking around, you know, next to legends that are just
literally rubbing elbows with everybody in the industry. It's pretty cool. So I used to drive Amy crazy, and I still do it occasionally some now. I'm not as bad. I know I used to drive her crazy. We'd be walking there, and I'd be like, that's Bob Trezola.
I did the same thing.
And I know she was just like, just shut up. Like, she was always nice about it, but like it was it's pretty cool. Like, I still do. I still get a little kind of starstruck when some of them is like, and actually get to talk to people then. I mean, like, stand there. Like, last year, we actually, speaking to Rick Hinder, we got to stand and talk to Rick Hinder for a good little while.
Yeah, I came in on that conversation for a little bit.
That's super cool, man. Just be in a casual setting like that, get to sit there and talk to somebody that you look up to and get advice and stuff. That's really cool. Yeah. So it's a very good opportunity. But shifting it back to Texas, before we get off of that subject, let everybody know your table number so they can start getting it on their agenda.
On the map, I am at 10K. So in the table 10K. Section, I am at 10K. So
all right.
That's where I'll be.
And we will be at booth 309. So that's about all I know. I know a couple of my neighbors and stuff or whatever, but other than that, I think we're kind of central-ish in the booth area, if I remember looking at the map correctly. So
yeah, and I think I'll almost be able to see y'all, but it may depend on where, you know, the other booth in between is, and you know, if there's banners hanging up and all that, but
sure.
Not too far away.
So that's coming up. And one thing we didn't talk about this ahead of time, but on the note of show, something I guess maybe a lot of people don't think about that I think about a lot when it comes to shows, and I know you do too, is like figuring out how to display at shows and stuff.
Oh God. Yeah.
So, and I have to this day, I still have never had 2 years back to back where I'm like, okay, our setup's good. Like, this is the way I want it. Let's just do this again next year. Like, I'm never satisfied with how the table or the booth or whatever looks. Like, it's just always something I'm wanting to change.
Yeah.
So
I'm never satisfied either, but usually it gets to be like it is right now. And, you know, I got 25 days to finish all the knives. I don't have time to be building a new display or worried about, you know.
Right. You just almost need like somebody to help, like, you know, like some sort of a designer or something to help lay out and plan everything for the stuff. And a table can be by, I was obsessed over it. And you wouldn't necessarily know that. And that doesn't mean I'm good at it, guys, but I did obsess. I tried all kinds of stuff. And I'd look back on it and later in pictures and videos and stuff, and I'd be like, man, that I really don't like the way that looked or whatever. Because, I mean, you want your overall presentation to be, you know, to be representative of your brand.
Yeah.
And it can be really hard to figure out that and trying to get noticed, trying to stand out from the crowd, you know, and get where people can see you. And it's a lot of logistics there to think about that the guys don't think about.
Yeah. Trying to display it in a cool way that, you know, makes sense for your brand, but also easy to transport is another thing that's, and some guys don't do the easy to transport thing. I know there's some guys that lay out all sorts of stuff and they're bringing in like six totes.
Very elaborate. Yeah.
To fill up a table. And I'm like, dude, like, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah. I've tried to try to strike that balance, as you know, cause even now to this day, you end up helping us some with the booth coming over. So,
I mean, with a booth, I feel like if it's six tubs worth of product, that's different, but with, you know, just decorations and stuff. I mean, that's,
I think you can get carried away with it. I don't ever want to be the point that it distracts from the knives, you know, from the product and stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, again, you do want to, I also don't like it when it looks like people didn't put any effort into it either. And
this
it's like,
true.
Just slap a banner up and like, you know, here I am. Like, I don't know. There's a balance there somewhere.
Yeah.
And that's just my personal, you know, there's nothing wrong with just, you know, throwing a banner up where, which is honestly like for Texas, this will be our first time having a booth anywhere besides Atlanta. So Atlanta, we kind of have figured out because we drive there, which we're driving to Texas too. But in Atlanta, we always have more help. It'd be me and Amy, and we always bring at least one other person. Ever since we've had a booth, we bring one more, an employee with us. And then you usually come over and help out. We've had some other people kind of help us in the past.
Yeah.
But in Texas, it's just going to be me and Amy. And so, I'm not taking the big, heavy, like, wall and booth and all that that we've got to move in there. And, you know, I'm sure we could probably find somebody to help us out. There's plenty of just, you know,
our
community's awesome. But I'm not going to, you know, bank on having to go ask somebody for help. So, we are going with basically like a big banner for the back. And then, I'm actually probably fixing to order some new tables, some like high rise tables or whatever. And we're going to probably get some, if we have time, get some custom tablecloths made to go on them. And that's probably going to be maybe some runners or something, but like nothing super elaborate as far as like a big wooden wall and, countertop and all that, like we do it at Atlanta. But
anyway, that makes sense.
I mean, when we go out to Utah, we have to fly. So, And, you know, yeah, I could ship stuff out there and all that, but you gotta figure out where the line is and what's worth it as far as the expenditure and all the trouble and stuff and what's not. So
yeah.
Anyway, just one of those things that we all have to think about that, most customers probably don't think about. I mean, they probably admire some of the booths that are the more elaborate ones at the show, wherever, but not many people probably realize what all goes into doing that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Some of them are very, very elaborate, very time consuming, very costly.
Yeah. Like the Vegas Forge guys, like theirs is all like metal and welded
pipes
and LED lights. And I'm like, that's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But,
and all the guys, the bigger guys that get their like big signage hung from the ceiling and stuff, like they're having to rent boom trucks, like they're having to pay the logistics people. I mean, it's a small fortune to do all that stuff. Like there's a lot that goes into it.
Yep.
Which kind of goes back into the discussion a few weeks ago about, you know, all the kind of hidden costs that people don't think about with knives. Like all of that factors into the cost of your business. You know, that's, you know, whatever you do, that's marketing, that's all, you know, that all the what you sell your knives for, you know, how many you sell, how much money you bring in from your knives is all goes into a pool and it has to go in all these different places, you know,
like every
it has
to
cover
direction.
All these different things. It's way, way, way more to think about than just, you know, oh, I covered the cost of my materials and a little bit of labor and that's it. Because otherwise you don't have any way to cover doing any kind of marketing and, you know, logistics for shows and stuff like that. So anyway, all right, before we get too hung up on that, I guess we should probably move on. I believe you have a freak of the week for us this week.
I do, and it's a maker that I'm talked with a good bit. He's a fixed blade maker. His name is Jacob Ginsburg. His Instagram account is at Jacob Creates, and he works out of San Diego, California, and he just, man, I don't know how many he puts out as many knives as he does. I mean, I know he uses some machine shop stuff, and like, he's got some friends out there that help him with machining of, you know, different stuff, but like still, even with that, I believe all the blades are hand ground, they're hand contoured. He's still doing all the kydex and he also uses some leather and stuff too from, another leather maker and all that, but just the consistency and the quality of his work is constantly impressing to me. He does a line called the Hail Mary series where it's basically same handle shape and bunch of different blade shapes, and he's been doing a lot of those lately, and they just every single one of them looks as good as the last, and they're all just tight and right, and that's impressive to me. Consistency and like not just consistency but also like an excellent quality of consistency is, you know, one of those things that just impresses me because it's hard to do. And
consistency, if it's not good, is consistency on something bad is not a good thing.
Yeah. But
consistency and quality together for sure are important. So that's cool. Yeah. I've seen some of his stuff too. I don't follow him as closely as you do, but yeah, definitely some good looking stuff. So
that, and he's also just, he's a, I guess, you know, champion of the knife community. Anytime, you know, I guess some of our younger makers, friends that I talk to and stuff, like, you know, anytime one of them's running a lottery or auction or one of them has something for sale, he immediately reposts it. You know, he's giving them shout outs. He's always happy to help as far as technical stuff and knowledge and whatever else. He's, you know, super good dude. So y'all go give him a follow.
Yep. He's absolutely
doing good work. So that's at Jacob Creates, and Jacob is with a K and an E. J-A-K-E-B Creates. Yeah.
So, a little weird, but hey, that's okay.
Yeah,
sorry, dude.
Like, it happens.
Not weird. So, is it Jacob or is it Jake B?
Yeah, I think it's Jacob. I'm pretty sure it's Jacob.
Jacob. Okay.
Yeah, because in his profile it says Jacob Ginsburg. But it looks like Jake B is why he's asking.
Screen names and the name people use on Instagram sometimes throw me off a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I've never, you know,
trying to figure out.
I've never seen his driver's license or his social security card. You know, I'm. He makes cool knives. That's all I know.
Very cool. Jacob with an EB makes cool knives. That'll work.
That's it. But yeah, I just want to give him a shout out this week.
Yep, absolutely. Glad to be able to spread the word about some other people doing good stuff, because there's a lot of them out there. Yep. A lot of people deserve a lot of recognition. So I believe you had at least one question for us, maybe a couple.
Yes, we're jumping into questions.
Well, okay. The one was, I guess that wasn't technically a question. Sorry. The question about our businesses, I've already called it. Amy posed the question, to me, that it would be a good topic, which would be just because we kind of hinted around about some stuff about it in a way, I guess, like just talked around it.
Yeah.
But basically that to kind of lay out where we see our future plans for our businesses going.
Yeah.
So kind of what our goals are, not necessarily too specific, but just a general idea of what our goals are. So since I mauled the intro to it, I'll let you start off while I recover my
capacity here. Oh, great. You're going to hand it off to me. Me having all the plans in the world.
Might or might not have been planned.
Yeah, well. Yeah, that was a question that one of, supporter of mine and yours and the podcast had posed, and you had kind of mentioned it too. So I figured it'd be, a good thing to hit on, was sort of, where do we see our businesses going? And, for me, I'm trying to get to that point where I can get a CNC at some point and sort of lessen the time as far as like individual handwork and increase production and, that whole thing that CNCs do. I don't know if I'll ever, at least in the near future, I don't know if I would necessarily want to go full bore and do like what you're doing with a whole bunch of people, because I thought that was what I wanted to do. And then you put me in charge of people for a brief amount of time, and I was like, I do not really care for this. I don't like being in charge of other people. It's hard enough being in charge of myself at this point, so I don't think I've got that, maturity level as far as a business owner and stuff yet. So where I'm not confident enough for, sound enough to know where, like, if other people do things wrong, I will, take it worse than say you would or something. Think it requires a certain level of maturity to get to that point where you can kind of take that on the chin when, like, for example, when I came in your shop and, screwed up something, burned through 8 drill bits trying to drill one hole, and I don't know if I would handle that as well. So, because I burned through some drill bits now.
I haven't always handled it as well as I should either, but I was going to say when you first started talking about that it's it is kind of a maturity thing to a certain extent. And, you're way younger than I was when I started making knives. So, but even in the beginning, I don't know that it's as much an age. Some of it may just be a straight up age thing, but some of it may, I think, is a maturity as a, maybe not so much a knife maker, but as a business owner, like you said.
Yeah. I wasn't necessarily saying like social maturity, although I am, possibly considered just a big kid, but
there is a certain amount of because it's hard. It can be really hard for somebody that's still pretty young themselves to look at hiring people and having them work for them. Like it's, that's actually a question that gets asked a lot to some of the podcasts and stuff that I listen to as far as like business type stuff, like younger people trying to figure out how to get, how to communicate with people that are under them that are actually older than them and stuff like that. So there's a certain amount of that too, but I think, it just develops. Some people, when I was as far into it as you were, I probably would have said that I wasn't, anywhere near ready to like deal with hiring somebody where I didn't feel like I knew what I was doing well enough to, which is still true a lot of days now, but
It's also sort of a confidence thing, I think, like where, I don't know if I'm, doing everything right. So I don't want to hitch somebody else to my wagon at this point either. So,
Right. So you said, question you a little bit on it here. So you said, basically, I feel like you probably kind of want to maybe at some point go the like full production route, but it'll just be a matter of, whether you get comfortable with, hiring people and that kind of stuff too.
Yeah. Probably. Yeah. More so productionized, I guess. I don't know if I'm, I don't necessarily enjoy making like full custom, you know, I do and I don't. I don't know. Like there's days right. where like I want everything to be consistent is my main thing. And I struggle to do right. that with my hands in my current process. Right. And so,
well, that's not, one of the things. Not to discourage you, but that's also another big challenge when you start taking on employees.
Yes. Like, that's
it's hard enough to get to do things consistent yourself, but then to teach other people, especially if you get more than one person doing the same job,
mm-hmm.
like that can be very difficult to get consistency from one person to the next and stuff. Yes. So not impossible, but it's definitely requires some patience and that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, ideally, like I would really like it if, you know, this is, you know, totally like, you know, dream world, I guess. But if, you know, if what was my perfect day in a knife making shop in a knife making capacity, it would be prototyping and designing would be my job. Yep. And then somebody else would be responsible for making it and getting it out to the other people. But every day right. for me would just be that, because, you know, the prototyping, that first one, when you're initially making it, is exciting. Right. You do everything right. and you're, you know, everything's just clicking and rolling and you're excited right. about it. That's what I would like to capture.
Creating. Like, you're not, I feel like when you start making, when you're prototyping, it's creating. When you're, once you prototype and you're doing more of something you've already done, you're making, but it's not necessarily creating.
Yeah, you're recreating. I've never
actually thought about it like that, but yeah, you're kind of like recreating, or you're just, you know, making, but yeah. you're not, you're still bringing, you're still creating something. You're still taking raw materials and creating a product out of it, but you're really creating when you're prototyping. You're taking something that's in your head and turning it into an actual object, a real life object. You know what yep. I mean? So yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
To be honest, dude, that's like what you're describing is what a lot of the, you know, that's pretty close to kind of what I do now.
Yeah.
Still with some other stuff thrown in, and for sure some of the other people that are farther along than me. I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I would,
a lot of anything, so
I would want to hire, somebody else that was like the public figurehead also. And like the, they're the overseer yeah. and stuff. And I'm just, you know, I'm that's just the guy,
too.
But
yeah,
that's the hard part about trying to do that. I mean, I guess I'm sort of just describing like, you know, some of the designers out there that, you know, sort of just design and prototype and send their right. stuff off to get it made overseas. Well, I just don't want to do the overseas part. That's the hard part. And I guess I would want to also control the manufacturing process because I'm a bit of a control freak also. Yeah. So there, I wouldn't want to just send it off to anybody either. So I would want to be hands off, but I also couldn't at the same time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I get you.
There's the future of my business in a tangled web of words.
Yeah. Well, but that's, you know, so for now then this, so that's, you know, I think probably it's just one of those things where you can kind of come to terms with some of the stuff that's involved with going that route.
Yeah.
And time will tell on that. I know, I mean, you certainly have the capacity to do it if you ever decide to do it, for sure. But so in the meantime, you're talking about getting a CNC. Mm-hmm. So you're basically just wanting another tool to help to basically do what you're doing now, but be able to do it with more volume. And you know, you mentioned consistency, of course, yeah. too, but essentially allow you to do what you're doing now, just with more, with an increase in volume.
Basically. Yeah. That's the near future.
Some of the annoying, you know,
yeah.
time consuming stuff that drives yeah. me crazy.
Profiling 10 sets of titanium frames one after another is not the funnest thing. Monotonous. So yeah.
Yeah. Or so does loading and unloading pallets. So.
This is true.
Doesn't take as long as profiling handles, but
yeah.
it all still, yeah.
Yeah, if I could get a shape to start with, and you know, that would help a lot of things, and have the holes already all where they're supposed to be, and you know, those right. sort of things. Like instead of clamping every one to a pattern and right. doing the whole thing,
some of the stuff is a total pain to do, yeah. and to try to be repeatable and trying to use, you know, just patterns and stuff like that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you mean. That's so for the foreseeable future, that's your plans, is to try to build up to get a CNC. And yep. be able to kind of streamline your production a little bit more, but still be making essentially handmade knives with a CNC.
Yeah.
Which brings me to I'm going to go ahead and say this on here to hold our feet to the fire and just so that I don't forget. But in a future episode, maybe next week, I want to talk some about kind of the blurring of the lines between everything to do with our industry now. Like, what, you know, what things are called, like, you know, custom production, mid-tech, small batch, like, whatever, like, you know, just the titles and stuff. So that's a, probably a pretty deep rabbit hole. So we'll save it for another, another episode, but for sure that ties into that. So
what about you as far as the future of your business and where you're wanting to go?
So I know, but I don't know. I definitely do not really have a ceiling for how big I would like to get and stuff, except for the fact that I feel like at some point you kind of reach, if you get to the capacity where you can make a certain number of knives, and I don't know what that number is, but I kind of feel like if you get to the point where you're making a certain volume of knives and stuff, that you're kind of moving into a different category than where we're at now as far as the, you know, number one, the price point. Because you don't typically have really big companies that are making thousands and thousands of knives, making knives at the price point that we make knives at.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I guess kind of where I'm looking now is something like Chris Reeves Knives. Like, they're a pretty big operation. I don't know exactly how many employees they have. I've asked him, and I think I remember what he said, but I don't want to quote it because I don't remember for sure. I mean, they're much bigger than we are. Like, we've got lots of room to grow to even get near that point. And they've still been expanding. So, and they're still, you know, they're kind of in our category. They're still, as far as price range and the types of stuff that they build. So I feel like they're a pretty good example of where I would like to go. Not necessarily, I mean, and again, they're still getting bigger. So I don't know how far you can push the envelope with getting bigger and making more knives before you kind of push yourself out of that, you know, small batch or whatever kind of production, the higher end production type stuff. And I mean, I may be totally wrong. I mean, Chris Reeves knives might, you know, quadruple in size over the next 5 years and still have a 4-year backlog. You know, I hope they do.
Yeah.
I mean, that'd be great. So, you know, I may be wrong. There may not be a ceiling to it. You may be able to just, you know, as long as you do things right, you may be able to, you know, just keep increasing capacity to, you know, with no ceiling to it.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't know the size of the company at all, but like Randall Knives, I mean, they've been around, you know, close to 100 years, like 80 years. And, you know, they've still got a 5-year backlog right now.
Right.
You go on their website to order a knife and you got to wait 5 years. And you can only order one every 3 months or something like that.
And I don't know a ton about them either, but I think part of that too is that I don't think that they have changed their manufacturing methods a whole lot.
Like,
they're not trying to streamline stuff. I think they're still basically a bunch of people making handmade knives.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, that's a little, in a way, a little different business model too. I guess that's kind of where it depends on which kind of fork you take. Because if you start, I guess, as long as you don't start, you know, adapting manufacturing methods that kind of cheapen the process or cheapen, you know, that essentially, I don't want to say cutting corners.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
but you know,
there is a difference between the price points and stuff.
I mean, yeah.
It just, I mean, there just is. There's typically, I mean, there's a reason that people can afford to make a knife for, you know, $200 when somebody else is making one for $400 or $500. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think Buck makes a good knife, but Buck doesn't make a knife that's in the same price point as you or I. I mean,
right. I mean, they're also using parts that are stamped out and
there's
things like that. I mean, there's different, it's different processes and stuff. So
yeah,
they're not just taking raw sheets of material and I mean, they are, but they're getting there a different way.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely not going to put in my mind, I don't want to put a ceiling on that, you know, we can only produce X number of knives a year and not turn into a, you know, production company that has to sell knives in a lower price point. Because like I said, to be honest, like at the age that I'm at, I'll probably run out of life before I reach that point anyway and have to worry about it. So it's just one of those things. So it just takes a certain amount of time to build up. I'm not, you know, I just don't foresee. I'm talking about like these plants that have like, you know, 200, 300, 400 people.
Yeah.
Like most of those, at least off the top of my head, are not making knives in the $500-$600 price range.
Yeah.
You know, they may have a few special ones here and there that creep up to a little higher price range, you know, like special edition stuff or, you know, special materials and stuff like that. But their average knife is not in that price range. Whereas you take people that are like Chris Reeves, us, Hinder, you know, Strider, these people, I mean, they are.
And yeah. K-Bar, Buck, ZT, right. You know.
Right.
Kershaw's USA, like they're different things.
Right.
Different.
Right. And the other ones are not bad. They're just hitting a different segment of the market.
Yeah, different price.
I don't know. I'm not sure that I ever want to try to catch that segment of the market. I guess what I'm saying.
Gotcha.
I don't know that I ever want to shift to trying to have. I don't know for sure that I even ever want to shift to having an actual budget line. Like, I mean, Lamborghini doesn't have a budget line.
Yeah.
I mean, which I don't, we don't try to be, you know, as we're not as souped up as a Lamborghini in the knife world. We're definitely more on the utility side a little bit, but it's still, you know, I think there's something to be said for maintaining a slightly more on the higher end luxury end of things than trying to reach everybody.
Yeah.
You know, in all price points or whatever. So there's people out there that are doing well at those price points. So, At least for the time being, by next year we may be having this talk, and I may have a completely different outlook. But right now, you know, we're doing all we can do to make everything we can anyway. So it's not like we have the option to jump into making, you know, 50,000 knives a year immediately anyway. So, but that's where I basically see it headed. It's something along the Chris Reeves model of continuing to try to grow. And find a good balance between trying to maintain higher end knives that still feel special. And I think that's the biggest thing to me is when you get a knife like ours, like Chris Reeves, like Hinder's, I honestly think even if you didn't know that much about the company, I feel like you could almost feel, and I don't mean feel as in like an actual like, tactile, like, you know, oh, this is smoother than
sensory,
whatever. Yeah. But like that, just this like feeling, like you can tell that something more went into that knife than like a $200. I'm not knocking Kershaw, but like a $200 Kershaw. Like you can just tell that it's not as much of a mass produced.
I mean, yeah. I think if you picked up one Mac 2 today and another Mac 2 in a week, I don't think they would feel exactly the same, and that's not knocking your quality or consistency,
right.
But like, I think if you picked up one Kershaw this week and one Kershaw next week, they would basically feel exactly the same.
Right. So, and it's kind of like, so I guess what I'm trying to explain is like, say you go to a flea market, mm-hmm. right? And you're walking around and in a flea market, you're going to find lots of junk and stuff there, right? Say you're shopping for hammers, all right? Or whatever, you're looking at hammers and you pick up one hammer, and it's obviously a made in Pakistan or whatever. It's just a generic, you know, just a generic hammer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you find another one that's maybe a little bit well used or whatever, and it's obvious that it was like a, you know, like a higher end or a handmade or a, you know, I couldn't tell you a brand, and I'm not talking about like a difference between Pakistan and East Wing. I'm talking about like an old hammer that was made, you know, like back in the 40s or 50s or something.
Yeah.
Like even if the cheap hammer was made in an earlier time in the same time frame, there's still a difference to what the feeling it gives you.
Yeah,
that's, I guess, when I'm saying a feeling, it's more not like the actual feeling of the knife, but the feeling it gives you, like the emotional connection, mm-hmm. or whatever you have with that object. You can just tell there's like a story behind it. There's like, it's like I've always described it as having a soul.
Yeah.
Like it's like that item has a soul. Like when you pick up something that, you know, even if it's not used, I mean, if it's used, it's really cool, because you can think about all the stories that it's got behind it and stuff like that. Who used that knife or that hammer or whatever it was used for and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Same thing with machinery. You know, we've talked about it with some of the machines that, you know, like that surface grinder that you got from me. Like it's, you know, It's cool to think about. Who knows? It may have been something completely totally boring, but who knows what kind of stuff was made on that thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just feel like there's a difference when you start getting into the really you know, mass produced stuff, there's a lot of difference between that, just the vibe it gives you, the feeling it gives you, whether it kind of has a soul or not. Like you just can,
yeah,
you just get that feeling, that vibe from something like that that's not as mass produced and stuff. And if you can produce a good quantity of stuff and still maintain that feeling, then I think you've pretty much like hit a home run.
Yep.
So I guess that's what I'm going for, to produce a good number of stuff, good number of things without reaching the point that they feel just mass produced and start to lose that soul.
Yep.
So
that's a hard balance to try to, you know, to kind of carry if you're, you know,
right,
still trying to produce as many as you can. And, you know, of course, you know, like you said, right now you're still at, you know, don't necessarily have the capability to produce wild amounts, right, but like, you know, that's a tough thing, I think, for companies that reach that point where they're producing more basically than, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think I've thought about it a good bit lately, just because, you know, again, I'm looking towards the future. And I think one of the things that can kind of help to balance that out is by, you know, offering different models and stuff.
You know?
If you're making, you know, thousands of the same model over and over again, it's going to start to be and feel more mass produced. But if you spread that capability of, you know, you can make X number of knives a year and you spread that out over different models, well, now you're still not just cranking out thousands of the same model over and over. You've got a variety of stuff, and that gives you a lot more room to grow before it starts to feel like they're just straight up mass produced.
Yeah.
In my mind. So,
yeah, I mean, I agree. That's why, I mean, you know, like, Chris Reeve, Hinderer, you know, Strider, they've right. all got multiple models and, you know, multiple right. different fan bases for each model and all that. And that's one of the things that I struggle with, because I want to have a whole bunch of different models and sort of a diverse catalog, I guess, but it's hard to be stretched that thin when I'm, you know, it's hard to gain any right. momentum basically doing a little right. bit here, a little bit there, you know.
Yeah, in the beginning you kind of got to, you know, honestly, in my mind, it's almost like you need to get one or two really good, you know, things that people like, a couple of good designs that people, you know, start to get some attention, get the ball rolling with that. And then before you run it in the ground, then you kind of move on to something else.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of feel like you can just shotgun it a little bit too much too, and just, you know, yeah. spread yourself out too much, and you've got all kinds of stuff out there. And then without giving any one thing, I have learned from doing this is it takes, at least for me, it always has. Now, maybe for other people it does not, but for me, it has always taken way longer for something to catch on and start to get popular and stuff than I wanted it to, or than I thought it should. You know, I come up with a design that I think is super cool and all that. And then, you know, it's like, you know, make the big announcement, I show it and get some oohs and ahs, but then it's like crickets, and it's like, oh man.
Yeah.
But it's just me being unrealistic and not putting in the time and effort to keep putting it out there, because that's something that you and I have talked about, and I forget on a regular basis and have to remind myself how often you need to put stuff in front of people to get them to truly pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, that's even, and you got to, you, at this day and age with social media and stuff, you've got to put stuff out there a bunch of times to even get a decent number of people to see it. Because each time you put something out there, you know, I'm looking at my account and I'm like, okay, I've got X number of followers and I posted this knife, so I've got X number of people now know about my new knife. No, like maybe 3% if I'm lucky.
Yeah.
Saw it, you know? And so it's really easy to get into that trap of feeling like, you know, okay, I've shown the world my thing, why is the world not responding better? And it's just, oh well, that I didn't know what you were laughing about for a second.
Sorry.
So, shown the world my new product.
Yes.
And the world is not reacting the way I want them to. I definitely don't want to go down the other road.
No.
So there's a reason we're from the like chest up here.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
All right. So, on that note, would you like to discuss the mechanics of folding knives?
Sure. Why not?
Yeah.
So, this came up. Some of you that follow me and stuff may have seen posts that I made earlier this week about some stuff as far as the pivots and all. And so I just thought it would be good to go ahead and talk about that a little bit on here too, because we really want to try to start educating people on why some of the things are done the way they're done. And I can be honest with you, most of the stuff that I do at this point on our knives is because I've tried the other ways and they sucked. Like, it's, I mean, some of it's just from, like, people telling me stuff or whatever, reading in books or whatever. But at this point, I've tried enough variations of all these things that it's kind of just, all right, this is what works because all the other ways sucked. So in this instance, what I was talking about was the tolerances of the pivot and it, how it fits in the handles. All right. So in other words, how tight the pivot is, pivot barrel slides through the hole in the handle. So I brought this up because it's come up multiple times lately for us because we put the pivots in a tight press fit. Like we press them in with an arbor press. We don't have any intention of them coming out unless somebody needs to change out the hardware, which let me just go ahead and say, there is no reason to take the pivot barrel out of a knife unless for some reason there's somehow is something actually wrong with the pivot itself, which is like almost never happens, or you're actually changing out the hardware. If you're taking it apart to clean it, to lube it, to whatever, there is no reason to take every single piece of that knife apart and lay it out other than just that you want to. All right. Yeah. There's nothing about that pivot being through the handle that keeps you from cleaning anything, lubing anything, anything else. And the chances of you getting it back in there wrong or messing something up as you're putting it in or taking it out, or it's not worth it. That being said, it's not also not that hard to take it out and put the other one in if you kind of know a little bit about what you're doing. So, but back to why we do it that way. So obviously with us doing that, we're getting people that are like, oh, I was trying to take my pivot out and it won't come out. It's stuck and like acting like it was a flaw. The reason you want the pivot good and tight in the hole is because any play, so there's essentially like a triangle between the lock, the stop pin, and the pivot. All right. And if any part of that has play in it, has any room for movement, then it's going to cause problems. And the lock kind of, I mean, unless you cut the lock too short or whatever, there's not really like necessarily movement there. If there's movement there, it's probably coming from one of the other two, basically. Mm-hmm. Unless you just cut the lock too short to where it's, you know, whatever. But if it's locking up solidly, then if there's movement there, it's probably coming from either the stop pin or the pivot. So, and typically the stop pin doesn't have much play in it. Those are also, they're not as tight of a press fit, but they're a pretty tight fit. Where you really run into trouble is if the pivot has any slack. So, in other words, if the pivot has any ability to move the slightest bit in the hole from side to side. Because what happens is when you lock a knife up, you open it up and lock it up, it's basically any slack that's in that pivot is then going to come out of it. So that means it's going to shift slightly in one direction. And if you close it, especially if you close it hard, it's going to shift back the other way. And so, or if you open it, say you open it, and then where you really see this is you open it, even if you open it, unless you open it super hard, which you shouldn't be doing anyway, but if you open it just normal, and then you take and go to cut through something that's tough, or you're pressing down on some wood really hard or whatever, like you do a harder cut, then you're going to see the lock bar move over. So it might be at like 30%, and then it may move over to 50, 60. If it's really bad, it might even move over to like 70, 80%, which is no good, and it's probably going to stick when it gets there. Mm-hmm. And that's happening because when you're pressing down, you're applying enough pressure that it's actually shifting that pivot away from it, and it's allowing the lock to then move over, right? It's not actually the lock that's the problem. It's the play in the pivot. So, and again, we started off like when you were helping me make the very first Mac 2s, we started off with a tight press fit. Mm-hmm. And then at some point along the way, we decided in all my infinite wisdom that maybe that wasn't actually that big of a deal. And it's honestly before I understood this as well. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. So for the ease of making the knives, we started making them with a looser fit so that it was basically like a slip fit so that you could push it through with your thumb, right? You could just take the knife in and out without any tool. I mean, the pivot in and out without any tools. And so But then I started noticing that the locks were doing exactly what I just described. When you go to press down and cut on something hard, the locks would move over. So after investigating and all that, figured out that that was what the problem was. And now that that's gone away, our locks are way more solid since we've gone back to doing them. And this has been months ago that somebody asked me when we did that. And I haven't gone back and tried to figure out exactly when we did that, but it was months ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago. I remember I was over there right about the time you made the switch. And I think it was probably, 8 months ago.
At least I was thinking early last year was when we,
yeah, it was like,
switched it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, that's, I get people, I actually had somebody, what really prompted me to start talking about this was like, we had somebody that I think was on Facebook was like, yeah, mine was tight. Somebody was complaining and wanting to know why, you know, how could you get it out? It was too tight. And somebody answered was like, yeah, ours was too tight too. We took a Dremel and opened it up. So it's now nice loose. And I'm just like, dude, number one, you just voided your warranty. Number two, you just introduced more play into your lock than you just made the knife worse.
Yeah.
So, and I know it was just because they don't understand this concept or whatever, but like the end result, the knife, when it is assembled and being used, needs to work the best it possibly can. What we don't want to do, there's certain things we have to do to be able to manufacture the knife, but we're not going to cut corners and make it so that it's easier to assemble and disassemble by the end user if that means sacrificing the actual function of the knife, right? So I do try to put some thought into the end user needing to be able to take apart a knife and take apart, put it together, that kind of stuff. But I'm not going to sacrifice the important functions of the knife when it's actually being used to make it simpler and easier to take it apart and put it together. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like as long as it does not interfere with, you know, the function of the knife, then I'm fine with trying to figure out ways to make it simpler. All of our hardware on ours are T8s. That's to make it simple. So you don't have to have multiple bits. Like part of the reason we went with the threaded standoffs versus the threaded handle is so if somebody messes up, strips a screw, something like that, then it's not messing up a whole handle. It's just messing up a standoff. Like there's things that we try to do to make them more user-friendly, but not at the sake of sacrificing the actual quality of the knife as a working knife. And so that's one of those things that is, again, there's very few times when you actually should need to take the pivot out. And if you do, we'll be glad to coach you through it, or you can even send it in and we'll do it for you. But I'm actually even thinking about making some little kits that would have like a punch and a little block and stuff that would to basically for people to use for taking pivots in and out if they don't have an arbor press. So, because you can punch them in and out with a hammer and a punch too, you just got to be careful. But
yeah,
so
I've flared anyway, more than one pivot.
Kind of rant on that, but
huh. I said I've flared more than one pivot in my day. I know you have to.
Yep. You have to make sure that you use the right kind of punch or whatever, or it will lead to problems.
Yeah.
So, and actually on ours, to be totally honest, so here's what we do now. Because we started making the pivot fit tighter in the handle, but then we had the same fit on the lock side and the show side. And what we found was, it would be such a tight fit on the lock side because our lock side goes on last, right? Mm-hmm. And the pivot screw goes through. And you would not, it would be almost impossible to tighten the pivot up enough to push the handle to make it fully seat up the pivot the way it needs to, right?
Yeah.
So we actually had to back off and on the on the lock side, so we actually use two different size reamers. We use a smaller reamer on the show side and a slightly bigger reamer on the lock side. So it's still a snug fit. It's still like a snug slip fit, mm-hmm. but it's not so much that you can't overcome it by just tightening the pivot screw.
Mm-hmm.
And since it's so tight on the other side, that's enough to basically lock it into place and eliminate that play that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So again, a lot of thought, a lot of trial and error stuff went into the way we do these things. So then it's just kind of crazy them to be number one complaining about it and then being, but I know it's just because they don't understand why, which is why I wanted to talk about it. But then people being dribbling them out and stuff, and we've gone to all this trouble to use specific size reamers for the different handles and all that stuff. And then people, oh yeah, just dribbling out is good. I'm like, oh man, no, please,
please don't.
Please don't. There is a reason. I can be wrong, but there is a reason for most everything we do as far as how we build these knives. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, most of it's not just random. We're not just, you know, randomly making stuff tight for no reason or loose for no reason or whatever. There's typically a reason why it's made the way it is. So
yep.
You got any thoughts or anything to add on the mechanical lesson there?
Not really. I think you covered it pretty well. I mean, you know, it, you're trying to keep a perpendicular axis for the blade. And if this side is, you know, if one side or the other is loose, that allows this thing to wiggle and move and do things. Right. And when you're trying to have a precise here and a precise here with a stop pin, and you're trying to get all that lined up right, well, if one thing is loose, that causes the rest of the system to be loose. And I think, you covered it pretty well there.
Yep. So. Yep. And like you were just showing there with that between your fingers, and sometimes it could be just one end, but
yeah.
If the pivot hole on both sides is, say you, like we did them for a while, they were just a kind of a snug slip fit.
Yeah.
That, even though it may not feel like it, that still leaves.
It's a tiny little bit.
Right. That whole thing to shift forward or backwards, depending on which way the pressure is applied to it.
Yep.
And guys, you would be amazed. I mean, it's ridiculous how little movement it takes to make a huge difference in the lockup.
Mm-hmm.
It's partially because you're dealing with rotation. All right. So the lock, where it meets the lock bar, we may think about it linearly, but it's not linear. It's a rotation. The blade is rotating. So if that lock rotates the slightest bit in either direction versus that end of that lock bar, it makes a huge difference in the lockup. It can either be locking up too early or not locking up, or be way late with the slightest bit of movement. Because if you, believe me, I've learned from designing stuff, drawing it on the computer and moving something like a half a degree of rotation.
Yeah.
And then go out there and do that on the machine. And like the same thing with the detents and stuff, like anything that involves angles or rotation.
Yeah. The detents
is magnified significantly over something that's just linear.
Yeah.
So like you can move something by a couple of tenths or like a half a degree in rotation, and like say we rotate the detent ball a half a degree from where it was, and it'll make the difference from it, you know, the detent being perfect to being either having a bunch of lash or not
holding, not even in the hole. Yeah,
right. Yeah, like a half a degree. So yeah. Like it makes a lot of difference. So the I guess basically what we're saying is the tolerances make a lot of difference. All right, some stuff the tolerances are not quite as important as others. But when it comes to the lock and any of the stuff up there with the detent and the lock where it's dealing with rotation, it is a really, really important to have tight tolerances. So,
yep.
So,
right. With that, you want to hit a couple questions?
Yeah, let's knock a couple out.
All right. So, do you prefer the simplicity of making a fixed blade or the satisfaction of making a folder? And that comes from Have a Nice Day Knives, Australian designer friend of mine.
That's a good question. I don't really know.
I know.
It's, you know, I kind of, at this point, I would probably say I like the simplicity of doing a fixed blade. When I was first learning how to make folders, and it was still kind of a mystery to me, I probably would have answered the other way and said that it was a satisfaction of basically, you know, making a folder and everything functioning correctly and all that. But now that I, you know, kind of know what I'm doing a little bit on some of it, it's, I think I've kind of switched back to probably preferring like the simplicity more than the mechanics, like the stuff we were just talking about.
Yeah.
So what about you?
That makes sense. I mean, I definitely prefer the simplicity of making a fixed blade. I am far more familiar and at home with that process and, you know, far more confident in my abilities in that process. And I still feel like every folder is an adventure. And by the time it's done, I just want it to leave. I don't even like it. I don't even want it. I just want it to leave my shop and never come back. But that's how I feel about it. I definitely prefer the fixed
blades. Kind of different ends of the spectrum from where we're at on it. Cause like, I definitely felt like that a lot too, but then I'm so stubborn that like, it would drive me crazy. Like, I do not like to not be able to figure stuff out. So, you know, to go with that, when I do figure it out, it makes me feel really good. So it was a love-hate thing with the folders, you know, trying to, and it still is sometimes. I mean, we're still troubleshooting and like trying to brainstorm and figure out why something's doing what it's doing at times. But
it is really nice when you find that problem that's been going on for 2 days and you're like, why is this not working? And then all of a sudden you figure it out and you're like, oh, hey, look at that. It works.
Yeah.
But,
or sometimes figuring it out means slamming it down on the bench and all of a sudden it works right.
That's so true. Yep.
It has happened.
Yeah.
So don't recommend it, but if all else fails. All right. You got any more questions for us?
Yes, I do. From Inhale Tide Pods, I've got, what goes into naming a knife? Is it a gradual process or a sudden epiphany?
Let's let you hit this one first. I did the
last one. For me, I've had both, I guess. Sometimes I've designed and made a knife and then been like, okay, I got to give it a name of some sort. And then other times, you know, I'll think of a name and then I'll design something later. And then I'm like, okay, that name correlates with that. And I already have it named before I've ever even made like a, you know, a physical product or anything like that. And, that was sort of what happened with the Mudlarks. I was doing some history reading about like Victorian England and heard about Mudlarks. They were basically the lowest of the low of the food chain of the economic ladder, where their job literally listed on the census was that they were Mudlarks, and they would go down to the river and collect bits of whatever they could find and sell it, like pieces of wood, old chunks of coal. They were lucky if they found something that was metal. And that was like a banner day, but, you know, so that was sort of where that came from. But then, like, a lot of my other stuff, like the Cove, I just, you know, I name a lot of my stuff after geographic landforms and stuff because I have a degree in geography, and I figured I should use it in some capacity at the very least. So, you know, that's where a lot of my names come from. If they sound weird, like Lavaca and Bornhart and Esker, those are all landforms or land features that that's where those came from. So if I finish a knife and don't have a name, I go to like a glossary of landforms and look for something that kind of fits. So what about you?
Some of both, like you said. It's, I can't necessarily think of anything that I've ever like, so I know in the past I've been like brainstorming about names and then I've written some down. There's probably still some of my notes in my phone that I've still never used.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my tastes change with time too. So I don't, it's usually more coming up with a name after the fact. And it's usually more like, ah, crap, now I gotta, I mean, it's sometimes it's like, all right, it's the McNeese, you know, medium fighter or whatever. Like I gotta come up with something a little bit better than that. Although I have just used very generic stuff like that. I mean, the chopper was just my big chopper I used to make was just the McNeese chopper. Like it was, you know, it was basically literally just what style of knife it was. But typically it's kind of after the fact. And sometimes it just, I don't have as much of a ongoing theme as you do with the geographical stuff. It's, that would actually make it in some ways, at least for a while, easier, I guess. Until
you, that has helped, you know, at least having like a repertoire to pull from. Like,
yeah, just, like you said, you've got to, you know, you can go check the glossary and look for cool names or whatever. I've done the same thing. Like with the Skybolt, I thought it looked kind of like a missile or a plane or something. So I went and looked up like, you know, military, I think it was missiles. Yeah. Or it may have been aircraft. I can't remember. I don't even remember at this point, but anyway, it was something just, again, not to me, it kind of looked like that. So then I thought of that, you know, the Killer Bee, I thought it kind of looked like some kind of like a bumblebee looking thing, the way it, you know, it was a little odd shaped and stuff. So that's where that came from. The Mac 2 obviously is one of the ones that's the more generic, you know, it doesn't really have a name. It's just got more of a, like, you know, number. And on that note,
go ahead.
Well, so now, and maybe it started somewhere, maybe somebody had used it before I did. No.
Not that now, I know. And I knew a lot then. I don't know as much now.
Well, I do think there may have been one person that I wasn't aware of at the time when I started calling these the Mac 2s or whatever. But the machine-assisted custom thing, that is not what the Mac stands for in ours. The Mac in mine is literally just a play on my name. Like, it's not I just thought it was cool and, you know, sounded good and whatever. Like, and then now, you know, even at Blaze Show, there's a whole award section for machine-assisted customs. Like, it's a whole thing now.
Yeah.
And so, but to clarify, that is not what it stands for in ours. It's literally just a play on the name. And honestly, the first knife that I did that was production-ish, I guess it was probably basically a mid-tech, was I wanted something to distinguish the custom stuff from the stuff that was less custom. So I came up with a performance machine thing. And so the first knife was just the performance machine one, so PM1. Well, then after I named that and I got thinking about doing something else, I was like, let's see, PM2. And I was like, I've heard that somewhere. Wait, Latterco has a PM2. So that's out. So can't use that. And that right there, guys, that's the hardest thing about coming up with a name for knives. It's the hard part is not coming up with something cool sounding. The hard part is figuring out something that's cool sounding that somebody else hasn't already used. And then trying to do due diligence and figure out if it's been used before and that kind of stuff. Like, it's just that is the hardest part. And then even then you wonder, did you miss it? And somebody's going to come and start complaining because you stole their name and this and that. But you do what you can. And that's one of those things. Sometimes it just happens. But anyway,
I was going to bring up that point. So I'm glad you hit on it, of the whole Mac thing. Cause like, you know, I was there when you were going through this whole process. I own a PM1 and, you know, we're going through that whole thing. So I almost carried it today, actually.
Yeah. So I was literally just, I was trying to just kind of keep it simple so I didn't have to come up with like fancy cool names or whatever for every different model that we did. I was going to keep it kind of nice and neat and have the, originally, like I said, it was going to be like the PM1, 2, 3, whatever. And then once I realized too late after the fact, after I'd already called that one the PM1, that PM2 wasn't going to work. So, because, I mean, I guess technically there wouldn't be anything wrong with it in a way, but I wasn't going to do
it. I mean, it's sort of a nickname more than anything, but if you say a PM2, people know what
that's what people think of, right? It's not technically the name. It's the, like you said, an abbreviation, but still. So that's when I thought, okay, I'll think of something else. And that's when I came up with the Mac. And like, it doesn't actually stand for anything. It's literally just a play on my name. So, and so it was just the Mac 2, and it was the 2 because the PM1 was technically, so there's kind of like some blurring of the names there or whatever. So started with the PM2 of, as far as the actual first full production knife. So, and I don't know. And now the next one is actually going to not be the PM3 to really keep things mixed up. So
back and
forth. Okay. Which I'm probably fixing to, I started to do it today, but I didn't prepare myself or you for doing it. So I'm fixing to drop the, if anybody hasn't figured it out by now, which people probably have, I'm fixing to drop.
I've seen a few people who figured it out, but
I'm going to drop. I would hope so. I've dropped some decent hints. So I'm going to probably announce that this week, what the new model is going to be. Cause we're hopefully going to start prototyping later this week.
Sweet.
So
with
a little bit of luck, sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here, but with a little bit of luck, may have a, it won't be like heat treated, probably won't be ground and probably won't be heat treated, but at least a functioning blade and handles, hopefully put together to bring to Texas, but we'll see. So we shall see.
Yeah.
But anyway, so naming is hard. It sucks most of the time. Every now and then you'll have an epiphany and it's like, oh yeah, that just fits good for that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you real quick, one of the ones, let's see. So two of the last ones that I had to name were the two fixed blades that I, the two new fixed blades we did at the end of last year. So one of them, I already had a knife called the Agent. This is just a ring version of it. The reason that one's called the Agent is because a guy, I had a neighbor that was a state alcohol, what is it? The ABC board.
Yeah.
He worked on the ABC board. He was an ABC agent. And he had a buddy that was an ABC agent that did a lot of undercover work, which I didn't know ABC agents did, but apparently so. And he wanted a knife, and he came over, and he kind of had some features he wanted me to work into the design, so we kind of co-designed it, and then, so I just called it the Agent, basically, because it was made for him, and so then that was a ringed agent. And the other one that we called the Stalker, I thought, you know what, I love G.I. Joe stuff from when I was a kid, so I'm going to go look through some of the cool G.I. Joe names, and I found the one that, I mean, this was obviously like a military fighting style knife. So found one dude that was named Stalker. I was like, looked, and I found some other like Night Stalker and stuff like that, the names for knives, but I didn't see any in my quick search that were just Stalker. So voila, there you go. One from a real life person, one from a G.I. Joe character. So I'm all over the place with it.
Yeah. Is the Ridge Runner, is that sort of a play on the Rigid Raider almost?
No, I didn't mean to ask you that for a while. Not really. So the Ridge Runner was, if you got anybody that's big deer hunters out there, at least in this part of the neck of the woods where we have lots of hills and stuff, big bucks are known to kind of to travel down ridges a lot. And so since it was primarily designed as a whitetail hunting knife, its Ridge Runner was kind of a nod to like big bucks, basically.
Gotcha. I just didn't know if you kind of carried the Rigid Raider to Ridge Runner, you know, sort of.
Yeah, it does kind of, yeah. And maybe that somewhere in the back of my mind, maybe that being still kind of having that same ring to it affected my thoughts on it somehow. But
I had to struggle to remember to say the right name before I said it. So, yeah.
Yeah. So there's another example. That the Rigid Raider, that's named after a boat that I drove in the Marine Corps. So, like, I'm literally all over the place with names. It's just whatever inspires me at the moment, I guess. Oh yeah, the fixed B.
Yeah.
that was obviously an easy one. That was another one of the generic ones. I already had the killer B, so that's the fixed B.
Yeah.
So anyway, but so yeah, I'm not great at naming. I'm all over the place, and
but it is fun to do, I think, to name knives sometimes. But yeah, I enjoyed it.
And once. I think it's kind of important too. I mean, obviously, I don't think just a cool name is going to make a knife, but at the same time, I think it does help.
Yeah.
Have something that's catchy. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like cool, but something that's memorable and, you know, sticks with people, I think helps.
Yeah.
So,
I agree. All right. I think that's it for the questions for today. We've got a bunch more in the backlog. I just didn't want to overload us all in one episode. So,
yeah, we're already pushed over an hour again. So,
So what have you got going on this week or in the shop or current projects?
Quite a bit. We got some of the two fixed blades I was just talking about, trying to get some of those done for Texas. They shipped the heat treat last week, so we're just in limbo. Well, we'll probably make some handles sometime, maybe later this week for those. And then, so they'll be ready when they get back. And then I've got a couple of specials. I want to do a couple of semi-fancy knives for Texas. So I've got probably some inlays. We're going to do some inlays for those. Biggest thing though is if the material gets here, our water jet guy was in the middle of moving to a new shop and all that, had to completely break his water jet down and move it. And
yeah, I saw the Instagram post where they were shoveling that thing out.
Yeah. That looked fun. Another one of those reasons why he's my water jet guy and I don't buy one.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's back up and running now and said we should probably have our prototype parts for the new model probably this week, so we'll have to make pallets and start those, but I've got the programs pretty close to ready to go on those for everything except the bevels. We won't have time to send off, and I've got the blades cut out of Magna Cut, and I'd just rather send those off than if I'd done it out of something simpler. I would have just heat treated them in house and maybe tried to have one hand ground one done to show around at Texas. But anyway, so that's the main stuff, just getting a few little things finished up for Texas and trying to start the new product. The prototype has got to happen whether we get it done for Texas or not. We have to get started on that because I'm already a little bit behind schedule on where I wanted to be with that this year. So
gotcha.
That's kind of that. So what about you?
When my shop's not falling apart and my wife's car decided to break down the other day and all the things just keep breaking on me, but you know, I got the oven back up and running. I got got my element in and got it installed. It wasn't nearly as painful as I remembered, but then again, I think when yours went out and I had to replace them, I replaced all of them and had to do the whole thing, and I didn't know what I was doing. And
the element on mine's all one big thing.
Oh, it is? Okay, maybe that was why it was more painful.
One big loop, but it goes through it has two levels of grooves that it fits in. It's all one big connected loop, but you have to feed it through mine, through and then down and around. And
mine has a left and a right, so in the left one was basically just a down and an up, so I just had to feed the wire out the back, come down the loop and pop it out. So I remembered it being a giant pain when I did it for yours. Yeah, so
it was, because it's really long and it loops around the whole both sides and the back. It's like a continuous.
Yeah.
So it goes that through one groove, back down, and back around through the bottom. Yeah, that's a pain.
Yeah, it and was.
It's deep, so it's hard to, it's like, you,
yeah,
you know, almost shoulder deep reaching in there. So
yeah, but luckily mine wasn't that difficult. I was able just to pop it in and pop it in. I was done in 10 minutes. I put it off for half the day because I was dreading it. And then I was like, yeah, oh, well, hey, look, it's done.
There you go.
And like I said, I got my grinder currently rednecked, but the, I checked the tracking earlier and the parts are supposed to be here Tuesday for my new tracking assembly and all that. So
good.
Should be able to get that back online. And I'm still working on my five sets or my fleets of knives for Texas. They're starting to take shape. I actually got two of the fixed blades glued up this week.
Good.
So, yeah, I'm remembering why I don't do Kimonos anymore.
Is that, are those fleets kind of the biggest thing that you have left or whatever as far as getting ready for Texas?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've got a couple fixed blades here and there, but for the most part, that's what I'm taking is those five sets. Yeah. And so that's pretty much all consuming at the moment. So
yeah, awesome. That's a heck of a project.
Yeah, it's fun though. It's been interesting.
Between that's cool to think about. You know, put some thought into kind of landmark type stuff like that. So
yeah, I mean, and I stole the idea from David Sharp. To be completely transparent, I had somebody ask me the other day that was a good idea, and I was like, "Go tell David Sharp that," because he did like a 15-year, I think, anniversary set where he did a fixed blade and a folder and did like, I don't know if he did 15 sets, but he did, you know, some sets that's like that. And so, but
very cool.
All right.
Well,
I think that about wraps it up.
Yep. Let's make sure we hit them with the email where they can email the site.
That is knifefreakshow@gmail.com. Send us all your questions, suggestions, comments. If you want to yell at me, any of that, you know, concerns to make the show better. Let's go with that line.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yep. And guys, we really appreciate you. We'd also really appreciate it if you'd help share out the show. We are growing. We're getting more and more followers on here and we appreciate that. And again, like, as we've talked about today, some of it's just us kind of, you know, shooting the shit, but like, we're also going to try to do some educational stuff, you know, as far as the actual, you know, technical stuff about the knives and in the industry in general and stuff like that. So We'd appreciate it if you could help us. The more people can get educated on stuff, the better off our community will be. So please help us share the show out and send it to a buddy that is a fellow knife freak, and give us a like, a follow, all those good things. And you can always find both of us on Instagram and stuff. Feel free to hit us up on there. Yep. At some point, we'll probably do a account for the show itself. But right now, it's running the one account's about all I can handle. So
yeah. So I don't even do a good job on mine. So yeah.
Yeah, me either. So, all right. Well, we appreciate you guys and
let your freak flag fly.